Excision number 11940, reel 9.
Brigadier P.J. Jeffries, reel 9. You talked about the Stukas attacking you, Brigadier, and you said that it was quite a frightening experience. Had that any effect upon the men's morale?
I think it must have. They were very frightening. A large number, no opposition, either from the ground or from our own air force. And they came in making a tremendous dive from quite a height, but coming in from that dive quite low, and of course making a tremendous noise. They released bombs, but the bombs were not big. I wouldn't be prepared to say what they were, but they were not big. And they did a certain amount of damage, but far less damage than you might have expected from the noise and large numbers. In fact, of course, everybody was a bit frightened of having a bomb right on top of them, but I wouldn't think that many bombs landed on gatherings of troops.
Was it difficult to get the men going again after the attacks?
That's not quite an appropriate question, because at the time of that attack, C Company and D Company were both in position, and it's not a question of them getting them to move on or back at that time. I was moving between those companies when it happened. And I was concerned only with the few men I had with me, might have been half a dozen or so, in keeping them with me and keeping them, if possible, under some sort of cover as bombs arrived. But I don't think we were ever in great danger from them, as far as I can remember. Well, there was a fearful lot of noise and stuff flying about.
Can we turn to the German weapons, Brigadier? What type and quality of weaponry were you facing?
Well, we were facing really three types. Firstly, and this was what did us the most damage, was the German field artillery. A long time after, I don't recollect the calibers, but it would be probably the same as our own 25-pounders or 18-pounders, those sort of shells, firing shrapnel. I don't recollect that there was much airburst, and most of that artillery stuff was fired, firstly, at the tanks over open sights, because there were only 2,500 yards away, that would have been solid shot, but against us advancing with and behind the tanks, it would have been shrapnel, and of course it did do a certain amount of cause a certain amount of casualty. The second German weapons that, of course, one came against was the German anti-tank gun, which, of course, was fired mostly at our own tanks. I recollect that it was ineffective. Our tanks were sufficiently armoured not to be much damaged by the German anti-tank weapons. The third weapon which we were up against was a machine gun, I wouldn't know its calibre, inside the German tanks. And at the Beaurains crossroads, where we came into personal contact with the German tanks, of course, they swept down wherever we were in position at that crossroad with ordinary machine guns. And I wouldn't know what their caliber was, but I imagine it was probably the same as our own, which was B-303.
Did you have anti-tank guns with you at this time when the German tanks appeared?
There were no anti-tank guns at Beaurains. The brigade anti-tank guns did splendidly, but they were far away on the 8th Front, and they did damage to Rommel's tanks when he was moving round in a westerly direction, round the 8th Battalion. But we had no anti-tank guns with us.
What was the quality of the German troops that you met?
Well, I only met few. Firstly, I suppose 150, 200 surrendered to me. In charge of, I suppose, their company commander, who was very correct. The German soldiers themselves seemed to me very young and much shaken. Not much resistance left in them, only too happy to go into some sort of captivity. I was in very close contact, of course, at Beaurains with the tanks. And I remember the tank commander of the leading German tank, who looked a really splendid soldier, youngish, perhaps 28, that sort of thing, reddish hair, robust complexion. He hadn't got his hat on when he popped his head out of the top. But splendid patches on his collars, altogether an impressive looking chap. I've always remembered him and wondered what sort of a man he was and how he did in the war. I also have a German friend who was an officer amongst the infantry at Achicourt and Beaurains. And I see him once every 2 or 3 years. I visit him or he comes to me. A very kind, civilized chap. Not a regular soldier, but just a platoon commander at that time.
Was he able to tell you at any time how the British attack actually fared against them, how they felt?
Yes, of course. He was moving across the front in vehicles, moving really behind the German armored division. And he ran straight into the our tanks, our armored attack, had a lot of casualties, and all his vehicles shot to ribbons. But somehow he got out of it. He said it was fearsome.
What happened to the prisoners of war when you took them? You moved them back to what area? What is the routine for taking prisoners of war?
I whistled up the nearest NCO I could see and said, take two men and march this lot back to battalion headquarters. And I should imagine when they got back to battalion headquarters, they were moved on to brigade. That would be the normal practice. And after that, there would be the responsibility of the military police.
When the attack was underway and you were very much involved up in the Bahrain area, what communication, if any, did you have with battalion headquarters? Very much?
I had practically no communications. From this long distance afterwards, I cannot really say whether we used our wireless badly, or the wireless was bad, or we had insufficient numbers of sets. I cannot remember that, because of course later in the war wireless became excellent, but at that time it was in infantry battalions, was pretty well in its infancy, and our communications were very bad indeed.
What lessons do you feel were learnt by yourself at Arras, which stood you instead in the future?
In hindsight, it's hard to say. The first thing, of course, will be discipline and the necessity for control at all levels, particularly at company command level, but also at platoon command level. I would say that was one of the chief lessons. The second lesson, of course, was that if men get tired, their fighting efficiency deteriorates greatly. Therefore, fitness must then, and I suppose is now, be of vital importance. Now, I dare say if we had been trained to march and march as we should have been, instead of digging trenches and things just before the thing went off, we'd have done much better. Chaps wouldn't have been so tired. I think the third lesson would be the importance of senior commanders coming well forward in a moving battle of such complication as this. And I think in that respect the battle lacked control. We had never trained with tanks, but the timing of the attack was such that I don't believe having trained with tanks would have helped greatly. The tanks went into the attack far ahead of us. It would have been nice to have been able to communicate more closely with them, to tell us where they'd gone and what their difficulties were and so on. But of course we caught up with them, and their difficulties were then quite obvious. But training with them, of course, would have been advantageous. But I don't think it had a great effect, the lack of training, in that actual battle.
Were you able to recommend anyone for medals in this attack, this action?
Oh, yes. I sent in, written in pencil, on a little pad, my recommendations, which included one of the company commanders, a platoon commander or two, several NCOs, and so forth. But particularly in a contact battle of that type, very difficult for an acting CO to be able to do justice in his recommendations. And one must admit that.
Do you recall any stories of officers who performed particularly well?
Yes, of course, Ronnie Cummins, commanding the 10th, commanding the D Company, Crook, did splendidly. Kept D Company in good order right through that battle. Ronnie Rodham, C Company, Spennymoor, also did excellently because he got his company right up to the far end of Bow Rains. He himself totally exhausted, and the majority of his company. And when I visited them up there, I realized that there was not much chance of them withdrawing in good order because of the condition physically in which they were, particularly with Ronnie Rodham himself. He'd done awfully well.
NCOs, have you any recollections of any NCOs who performed
well? Yes, Sergeant Major Pallas I remember well. He did a fairly good job in the mopping up at Agnew. You know, a regular company sergeant major in a situation like that has a great opportunity really to shine. He can, of course, stick at company headquarters and control things there. But Pallas went forward and took command of a platoon that was in difficulties, and did a great job.
Under the ranks, Brigadier, does anyone stand?
No, I don't. Oh, I only remember my own driver, Iston. He did a marvellous job. Because you'd have asked me about communications. And I found really that I wanted to keep communications between battalion headquarters and the three forward companies. And most of the time, of course, I was on my feet with a runner who was also good. But I found that what I wanted was to use my 1500 weight truck. But of course, it wasn't a cross-country vehicle. It was only when we got to the roads that I could find Iston. And Iston was very good at finding me and was quite fearless about where he drove. And a tremendous lot of artillery fire would come down on or close to this old 1500 weight truck, of which he managed so well. I remember one place on the road running north and south, really, through the Bow Rains crossroads, a bit of a sunken road, and we stopped there, and over the top, about 50 yards away, were the remnants of two 4th Royal Tank Regiment tanks, and a good many dead. And there was a soldier in D Company with his leg blown off. And there was a lot of artillery fire flying about. But Iceton helped me, and French interpreter, Philip Bord, who happened to be with me, I don't know why. And we got this chap back, put him in the vehicle, with one or two others, less badly wounded, put them in the vehicle. And I told Iceton to push off back, take them to the regimental aid post, if he could find it, and then come back to me. Of course, he did this, got them all back to the ROP, splendidly. And then later in the night, came back to try and find me, and met the German tanks, who shot up his 1500 boat and wounded him. But being a man of resource, he managed to get back and got back to England, where he recovered. Great man.
Did anyone actually receive an award for the action?
Oh, yes. Cummings got an MC. Iceton got an MM. Pallas got a DCM, I think. The platoon, one of the platoon commanders in C Company, Blacklock, I think his name was, got an MM. There would have been others.
So you're back on top of the ridge at Vimy with the remnants of the battalion. What happened next, Brigadier?
Well, the general came and saw us. And, of course, the Brigadier. And I suppose for 24 hours we had a good rest. And we hadn't got very many vehicles, but we had one or two. And I sent them all scouring the country back to try and find my CO and any of the men and vehicles that he had with him. I got hold of A Company, Proud, which had been the reserve company, which was very fortunate. But that was all that I could do. So I ended up with really two companies and a skeleton battalion headquarters. Very soon after that, the brigade had to take up a position really to the left of the main ridge, to the left of the old Canadian trench system, which is up there. And we reconnoitred that during that afternoon and evening, and the next day took up positions there. It was the next day that one began to get a bit anxious. We had these two companies forward and our little headquarters at the back. And during the day, there was continuous ranging by German artillery onto the position held by the brigade. We had hoped that we were going to be relieved by 5 div. And, in fact, about midday, some 5 div personnel came through to reconnoitre. But while they were there, they got messages to say, no, return, you will not be taking over. So that's the last we saw of them. The day drew on, and as darkness began to fall, the brigadier came, and he said, this is a final stand, and there will be no retreat from this position.
What were your feelings when that was? What were your feelings when that was given to you?
Well, it's an interesting question. I don't suppose it very often happens to people. But I told the two company commanders I had, Leslie Proud and Ronnie Rodham. I said, we've got to stick this out. I couldn't think that there would be much hope, really, if the rest of the army were retreating as we knew, that we'd got to stay there. I thought, well, that's the end. I couldn't help wondering what I would do when the German attack got right up to me. Would I go on shooting? Would I surrender? Would I stay there and last man, last round? I didn't know. But I remember resolving that I thought that we must try and do the last man, last round business. Of course, at dark, the German guns still firing spasmodically at us, have got a message from brigade saying, cancel the orders, and if you can, and have sufficient vehicles, withdraw during darkness. And it gave the route that we were to try and follow.
Would this be about the 23rd of May?
That would be about the 23rd of May. But I remember the emphasis on this message was, if you think you can get out of this. By God, there was no difficulty in getting out of it. And with a great sigh of relief, I got the company commanders, and we had a few A echelon vehicles. And believe it or not, we loaded those vehicles in the early, late part of the night, the whole of those two companies. And away we went, thankful.
To which position were you now moving, Brigadier?
We moved into reserve, first of all, at Armentier. And we were lucky to have a whole day of rest there. But shortly after that, I suppose it was the next day, we moved back to positions on the Yser Canal.